Good afternoon, everybody. Hopefully, most of you have managed to get in. Apologies that there were a few issues with the Zoom link. I think when everyone's trying to get in at once, it sometimes is a little bit upset. But let's get started. My name is Anna Bull. I'm a senior lecturer in education and social justice at the University of York. And I'm also a co-founder and director of the 1752 Group. We're a research and campaigning organisation based in the UK, working to address the issue of sexual harassment and violence in higher education, with a particular focus on addressing staff or faculty sexual harassment and misconduct. And that's an issue that we've been working on since we were founded in 2016. We thought we would have solved the issue by now, but sadly not. And this webinar is jointly hosted between the 1752 Group and FemIdeas, which is a research project run by my co-director, Adrita Day, which is a project called Decolonizing Sexual and Gender-Based Violence in Higher Education. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of background to how and why this webinar came about. It's a year exactly since the book Sexual Misconduct in Academia: Informing and Ethics of Care in the University was published last March 2023 by Routledge, Taylor and Francis Group. However, in August last year, the book was withdrawn from publication after the publisher Routledge released a statement saying that they'd taken the step of withdrawing the book after receiving, quote, a series of legal threats from various parties, unquote. And this was in relation to one chapter, chapter 12. Chapter 12 was entitled "The Walls Spoke When No One Else Would: Autoethnographic Notes on Sexual Power Gatekeeping Within Avant-Garde Academia." It was co-authored by Lieselotte Vianna, Katerina Laranjo, and Mia Nadia Tom. So in September, following this book being withdrawn, we were involved in an open letter which was published calling for Routledge to republish the book. And that letter was signed by thousands of academics internationally. But now, a year on after the book was published, this is effectively the anniversary event, the entire volume remains unpublished, including 11 further chapters that were not subject to complaints. And we'll hear from one of the authors of one of those chapters today. So there's no route forward for publication currently. So we're going to talk about some of the implications of this situation. We're not going to discuss the Routledge example in particular, but we're going to talk about the issues that this situation raises, in particular, the implications for authors who are publishing work on gender-based violence in academia, and particularly on academic work. And talk about what support we need from publishers and from our institutions and from activists in doing this. And we'll talk about strategies for activism to ensure that publishers and institutions don't side all the time with the powerful and don't continue to silence the voices of victim survivors. And I'd just like to say thanks to the authors of Chapter 12 from the book Sexual Misconduct in Academia, who helped with putting the panel together and who we've liaised with in setting up this event. So I'm really excited to have four panelists with a wide variety of expertise with me today to speak about this issue. I'll introduce them in full detail shortly, just briefly, we have Alex Pittythorne from York University in Canada, Donya Amadi from Groningen University in the Netherlands, Tom Dark from Edinburgh University Press, and Dirk Verhoef from Ghent University, who's involved in initiatives around academic and media freedom internationally. And I can see that we have got quite a few people who've joined us. My apologies to those of you who've had a little trouble getting in, because lots of people were trying to access the Zoom link at the same time, then we had a bit of a backlog, and that's why you've maybe had a few problems. I'll just briefly say thank you to the funders of the webinar, SOAS and the University of Westminster, and also to say that we'll be putting together a short report based on the discussions from this webinar, as well as the webinar last week, which was a really fantastic discussion hosted by Adrita Day, my co-director of the 1752 Group. And so if you'd like to receive this report when it's published, we'll put a link in the chat to our mailing list. So please go ahead and join the mailing list and you'll receive this. We, due to the sensitivity of the issue, we haven't yet made a decision as to whether we're going to release the recording of the event. And we'll make that decision after the event. But if you join the mailing list, you'll receive whatever outputs come from this event, as well as from last week's event. Finally, in terms of practicalities, there is a Safer Spaces statement, which was in the sign-up page, which we'll now also post to the chat. And that's got links for support and information relating to this issue. And so just to say, in terms of organising this webinar, due to the sensitivity of the topic, we will be moderating all questions or comments before the audience can see them. So if you post a question or comment, we'll come to those in the second half of the event, but we will just make them visible to the audience one by one. So don't worry if you can't see what you posted. So what we're going to talk about, we'll spend the first half an hour, 40 minutes or so, and on a short discussion with each of the panelists to introduce their experiences and perspectives. And that will serve as a way of kind of getting a sense of the current situation and where things now stand around academic publishing and academic freedom. And then we'll turn to a discussion of what needs to change and what activism or support might lead to that change. Around 1:15, 1:20 or so, we'll have a short breather, and that will also be an opportunity for audience members to post questions. And then we'll spend the last half hour or so discussing any audience questions. So let's get started. As I said, in the first part of the webinar, we'll focus on the current situation. And I want to start with Alex and Donya, and giving them the opportunity to describe their experiences of attempts to silence their academic writing. And then we'll hear from Tom and Dirk how these experiences fit into the wider picture of what's going on. So I'll start with Alex. Alex Pettithorne is a doctoral candidate in anthropology at York University in Canada. And their research focuses on queer community building and gender-based violence. And they were the author of a chapter entitled Sexual Misconduct in Academic Liminal Spaces, Autoethnographic Reflections on Complaint and Institutional Response. And this chapter was published in the now withdrawn Routledge book, Sexual Misconduct in Academia. And this was one of the chapters that really, really sadly, we have lost, or at least hopefully temporarily lost, due to this book being withdrawn, which I'm personally very disappointed about, because it's an incredibly powerful piece of writing, and also a very brave piece of writing. So perhaps, Alex, if you could get started and reflect on why it was important to write this piece of work as an academic output, and also perhaps reflect on the impact on you as an early career researcher and as a survivor of having it withdrawn. Over to you, Alex.
Great. Thank you so much, Anna. So again, my name is Alex Pettithorne. I use they, them pronouns, and I'm a doctoral candidate at York University in Toronto. So just for some context, my chapter was about my experiences of sexual harassment and stalking as a graduate student at an institution in Canada. And the chapter reflected really on the institutional response to, or the lack thereof of institutional response to those experiences, because they were outside of what the institution found to be its own jurisdiction. So they occurred in union spaces predominantly. Thinking about that from the perspective of why does one write this piece and why does one do that work, personally, as a survivor, writing about those experiences, was a processing tool. It was something that was therapeutic. It was something that, before I was writing about it academically, I was writing about it personally, and that was something that was quite important. But coming at it from the lens of academic writing turning that from a personal experience into a piece of knowledge, writing academically about those experiences for me was really focused on bringing things that you know, in my experience, had existed in a whisper network, and encoding them into language and encoding them into published knowledge. So again, my chapter was really focused on response from the institution, and in a great way on institutional betrayal. And that's something that I think people who are active in this space and who study or do work in anti-violence prevention are quite familiar with, and it's something that we talk about quite frequently. But you know, not everyone is familiar with these ideas. So I think writing them down and producing this knowledge is important. I also think about my own experiences prior to this happening to me. You know, I had not heard about things like institutional betrayal. It had not occurred to me that the institutional response would be violent in and of itself. You know, this was brand new information as a 23-year-old graduate student who was kind of brand new to the space. So thinking about kind of little Alex back then and this person who really needed support, it was important to me to write and encode these things for the next people that came along that this would inevitably happen to say that this is not a unique experience. This has happened before. These are patterns, you know, at an institutional level. And here are some of the things people have done about them. So for me, the crux of why one writes this and does this work is not so much about telling my story in particular, though that's certainly helpful, but it's about ensuring that these things aren't swept under the rug and that these things do not just kind of disappear into that whisper network, and that knowledge is there for other people to find. Now, in terms of the impact that you asked about, Anna, you know, it impacts one in multiple ways to have this publication withdrawn. You know, as a survivor, it's triggering, right? It's triggering to do this work. It's very emotionally and psychologically labor intensive to write about these experiences to begin with. And I'm sure I'm not alone in saying that when you write about this work as a survivor, you know, you often have already had attempts to silence you before you get to that point, either in a complaint stage or, you know, maybe you're not supported in starting to write about a project, right? So it's usually not one's first experience of being silenced. So having, you know, a publisher silence you again is triggering. As a graduate student, you know, as an early career researcher, there's an impact on your career, right? It's, you know, it's a CV line, obviously, that is impacted, of course, but, you know, publishing takes a great amount of time out of one's schedule, particularly something that's this emotionally draining and labor intensive to write. That's time you can't get back, right? And graduate students run a very short clock to accomplish a great deal of things going on to a job market that is precarious, to say the least. So there's a real opportunity cost there to taking on this work and writing this kind of publication and then not having it materialize, right? That is time I can't get back. So there are those kind of material impacts on career trajectory. You know, and it impacts your willingness to engage with academic publishing going forward too. So, you know, how many people coming up against these barriers then don't write again? Or how many of these people do we lose who leave the academy because it shakes them so much? So kind of whatever angle we're approaching this from, you know, whether we're thinking about the psychological or an emotional harm or the career harms or anything else, you know, it's a really troubling message to be sending to survivors and to early career researchers.
Wow. Thank you so much, Alex. It's again, making me kind of upset and angry all over again to hear about this brilliant chapter being withdrawn and being no longer available. But we will come back to talking about some of your more positive experiences of publishing in this area a little bit later on. But I also particularly appreciate your perspective as a graduate student, as an early career researcher, because I think for those who are kind of coming into the publishing landscape, it's really, really important, you know, to hear how you're experiencing these processes. So we'll come back and hear a bit more from you a bit later, Alex. But I want to turn to Donya now, who has also had the experience of her work being threatened to be withdrawn. So Donya Amadi is an assistant professor of international relations at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. And her research addresses an intersectional feminist critique of Iranian nationalism. And she's published widely on this and related topics in academic journals and elsewhere. So I'm actually going to give a brief outline of Donya's current situation, which she's kind of given permission for me to do, because it is a little bit complicated. And then I'll turn to Donya to kind of talk about how it's impacting on her and how she's experiencing that. So in 2023, last year, Donya published an academic article in the journal Women's Studies International Forum about the Me Too movement in Iran. And in this article, as part of her wider analysis, she mentions an example of a man who had been named online within the Iranian Me Too movement. And after publication, Donya was subjected to three different levels of threats and complaints. First of all, she received personal threats of being sued for defamation. Second, the journal itself received a complaint. And as a result, the journal and the publisher who owned the journal, Elsevier, opened up an investigation asking Donya for evidence to support the claim that she made in the article. Now, Donya has provided this evidence, and at this stage, it appears to have been accepted as the article is still available. It has not been withdrawn. But on top of that, Donya's university, the University of Groningen, has also apparently received a complaint about scientific misconduct relating to her article. And even though the journal's investigation, even before the journal's investigation had concluded, and despite there being no finding of fault in the journal's investigation, the university has opened up a disciplinary investigation into Donya herself for academic misconduct, scientific misconduct. So the situation, of course, has very clear resonances with what's happened in relation to the Routledge book. But in this case, the publisher actually have not given in to the threats that they have received. So Donya, can you talk us through what this experience has been like for you and what you think the wider implications are?
Thank you so much, Anna. I want to say hi to everyone who's attending the seminar. I want to first start by thanking you for inviting me to be here. I'm quite frankly in the thick of it right now. I'm very much in the middle of everything that is going on. I'm still waiting for the University of Groningen investigation to come to a close. And I have sort of a package of very negative and very positive experiences that I can share. But right off the bat, I want to say that I'm not at my most articulate. I'm currently on sick leave. I'm also not invested in putting on a facade of, you know, appearing or sounding like this has not impacted me. Quite frankly, on a personal level, it has been horrendous, you know, psychologically, physically, materially. I have had to give up all my teaching for half a year. I do my teaching work with passion, I'm happy to say. But I want to start on an academic level, because I'm here as a scholar, first and foremost, and I want to link it to what Alex said. Again, I heard through, I heard about this, the chapter, through some colleagues here in Groningen, and it is quite shocking how the entire book has been withdrawn. I mean, I hear it from other people, how they express that they're shocked and disturbed by what is happening to me, but I am simultaneously in disbelief that this entire book, talk about all that labor, mostly female and, by some also queer people's labor, being completely erased. And normally our first sort of response is to go to an independent publisher. That's what I usually like to do when my work is too radical for mainstream lines of publishing. But this renders those publishers even more vulnerable, because usually independent publishers are not as strong. They don't have a whole legal department or a lot of finances at their disposal. So this will circle us back into the conversation of the kind of support we need from publishers in this. The first and foremost impact, Anna, going back to your question, as a scholar for me, is the chilling effect, which I'm afraid to admit has already started. I've become extremely paranoid of everything I write. I have now an article that is being peer-reviewed for publication, And it's not on the Me Too, it's not on sexual violence. It is on the Iranian women's movement, which continues to be a contested topic to our dismay. But the quite immediate result of this as a scholar for me has been that everything I say or write, I meticulously read and reread to make sure that no one can sue me on this basis. Because I mean, other people here, you've been threatened with a lawsuit. But the material impact on this and the psychological impact of this is huge. I mean, you have to deal with, for me personally, this was the first instance in my life that I had to deal with lawyers and, you know, the whole legal judicial sphere. You need to sort of educate yourself in understanding what these terms mean. The challenge of finding a lawyer, mustering up the finances to pay for a lawyer. I mean, lawyers charge you for a phone call, for any email, you know, so the bill keeps becoming bigger and bigger. And something that Alex said, which really resonated with me, was that especially those of us who are in feminist studies, anthropology, queer studies, you know, autoethnography has been a very sort of transgressive, decolonial tool for making sense of our own experiences, but nobody else wants to write about it. And oddly, in this process, the first thing that came to my mind was that the only way I can make sense of this as a scholar and as a human being is that I can utilize my experiences to talk about the issues that I see that are systemic. Oddly enough, a lot of the things that I'm experiencing right now are things that I've already theorized in my article. In terms of backlash, I mean, the person I've named in my article, I've named him as an example of retaliation against his survivors. So I have not named him as a perpetrator. The difference between my case and Alex's is that I have named someone who has already been named in social media, in Me Too discourse, hundreds, maybe thousands of times in Iranian social media, in Farsi Twitter and Instagram. So I have merely, and I continue to state this, that I have merely used publicly available information, as we do as scholars, but this somehow still has rendered me exposed to threats of defamation and of slander, so both civil claims and criminal claims before a court. But the chilling effect means that not only am I sort of compelled or forced to spend all of this time and energy, again, talk about the labor that goes into defending yourself against these claims. It is so incredibly disproportionate to the claims that these abusers raise. In my case, I have named this man alongside at least, I think, 7 or 8 other abusers, from very high profile international ones to lower profile ones, such as the man that is now coming after me. This man is only mentioned once in a full length peer reviewed journal article in one sentence. But that itself has cost me 3 months of my sort of time and effort, thousands of euros in costs, and at least a semester of my teaching and research duties. I have been on leave because the pressure has become too much. And this labor, I keep thinking, this price that I'm paying, and I'm fighting this, I'm going to stand tall, and I'm going to fight this and see to the end. I have done nothing wrong as a scholar, and I continue to advocate for that. And I think this is an experience, as painful as it is for me, that we can all learn from. And that's why I'm very invested in talking about it. Although talking about it renders me vulnerable, right, to more lawsuits, to more attacks, to more backlash. Not only you have to spend, going back to Alex's point, to spend all this time and energy and money, essentially, to survive these processes, that experience itself and the ability to reflect on it and to theorize it as scholars, which in a way is a very empowering exercise. It gives you a lot of solace because it allows you to not be a victim, right? To analyze the situation, to stand above and outside of it. This is robbed from us, because really engaging with this experience will again probably open up possibilities for lawsuits, for disciplinary investigations, and at the very least, you will be perceived as this trouble seeker, you know, even if the whole sort of chapter is closed. Anna, you know that I have a lot to talk about on this case, but I also don't want to take too much time from the panel. So I think it's better if you have specific questions and I ask them throughout the session and I stop here.
Thank you. Thank you, Tonya. That was very powerful. I will, before we move on to speak to Tom, could you just briefly say a little bit about how the publisher responded to the issues raised?
So the journal, so this, my case has been, the article came out in May 2023. The whole debacle, as I like to call it, started, I think already October, November is when the journal starts getting emails from this man, allegedly also his lawyers. I wasn't looped in, I wasn't CC'd in those emails. And he claims that I have fabricated these claims to defame him. And he sort of frames it as me being the first person who raises this, like a survivor would, I guess, similarly to Alex's case, which in that case still, you know, it's a discussion of why are survivors not protected, not allowed to talk about their own experiences without having to risk so much. So when this happened, I think in November, I got the first email from Lavinia Stam, the editor of Women's Studies International Forum. So Women's Studies International Forum is a very prominent gender studies journals, is one of the older ones, has been publishing since the 1970s. So it is a feminist studies journal. And I wonder, had I published in a non-feminist studies